So how are we all this morning? Right. Now, I'm expecting a little bit of input, a little bit of back and forth from you this morning. There is some parts where you can get involved and speak, and it's not going to be all one way. But if you get me the wrong answer this morning, I will ask you to leave. Whereas Steve said the other week with his red and green cards, there is no right and wrong answer. There is definitely a right and wrong answer this morning. So, by a quick show of hands, who owns one of these? I'm not talking about a Bernacell type old-fashioned phone with keys. I'm talking about a smartphone. So there's very few people that don't own a smartphone nowadays. Okay, so who uses this to check out social media? So whether that's Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, and all the other myriad of social media out there. So it's one of the main ways we use, or the channels we use to get to our social media. Who has checked their social media today? Again, a fair proportion of it. Only four. So I have some stats for you on usage of who's currently looking at their social media. For the purpose of those listening to the recording, I've just caused an argument between Steve and Louise. Marriage counselling is available. So just some stats about our usage of digital devices and social media. So according to recent research, we are now spending an average of 2 hours and 22 minutes a day on social networking and messaging platforms. So the average person checks their phones 80 times a day. Mike's like, that's nothing, mate. Completed it already today. And that averages out once every 12 minutes. You're picking up your phone, checking for messages. That, do you find that concerning, worrying, or just pretty normal because of the time, who you spend your time with? Worrying. Now, these stats are higher for millennials. So we've all probably heard this phrase, millennials, and it confuses the heck out of me because millennials go from anyone born in 1983 up until 1997. So, yeah. So you've got... Sorry, Matt, you've just fallen out of the bracket. But you get people of my age and Sarah's age, and then you get right down to the likes of Beth and Joe and Joe and Sarah Chester. So and you think, how are we all in the same bracket? But the stats are higher for that age group, and then they get increasingly higher for those that are 18 and below. I'm not saying that's good. I'm not saying it's bad. You might find it really concerning. But I read a book recently called Left to Their Own Devices, written by a Christian author from Care for the Family, and they talk about digital natives and digital visitors. So there are people that have grown up with the technology. It's just part of their everyday life. They are digital natives. It's how they communicate. It's how they share information with each other. So to speak to a friend over a messaging service through, say, Snapchat or WhatsApp is completely normal, and it's got just as much weight and as meaning to them as a face-to-face communication. But for those of us that are slightly older, we're like, that doesn't count. It's not real. Get your face out your phone. My mother agrees. I've had similar conversations with one of my nieces. Like, we'd go out for a beautiful walk in the woods. Oh, look at these amazing trees. And the, oh, look, a deer's just scampered through the undergrowth. Quick, quick, a swan is serenely gliding across the pond. Do you not want to take in all this beauty? What? Now, I made the mistake of, get off your phone. You're so antisocial. But what if, because she's a digital native, that's how she lives her life, that's how she interacts with things, how can I encourage her to engage with what we're doing through her mobile device? Just a quick thought there. Interesting one. How can I take part in her world? Because that's her everyday. That's a lot of people's everydays through their phone. Now, another stat there, 46% of us check our phones before we even get out of bed in the morning. Sarah Hewis. So, some people... Steve's like, I don't abide by that rule. No. Now, I purposely don't take my phone upstairs because I'll end up playing games on it. I'll end up scrolling through social media. Facebook, the guy who created the algorithm that means you can endlessly scroll through Facebook, says he wish he never created it because it actually is achieving what he created it to do, which was to keep you on social media for longer. Have you ever noticed that you're scrolling and 45 minutes later, you're watching yet another cat video? When you go home, look up cats versus cucumbers. You know, what are you on it? Cats are scared of cucumbers. There's no explanation for it. Just go and watch the videos about cats versus cucumbers. But a lot of our self-worth, a lot of how we see ourselves and view the world is being shaped more and more by social media. Okay? Now, I don't know if you know about the quite worrying trend. I just think it's just plain weird. Of people ordering clothes, putting on said clothes, taking a selfie in said clothes, posting on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, take clothes off, repackage clothes, send clothes back, get refund for clothes. In order to have an appearance that their life is all together, they're sorted, they've got all the latest clothes, but when the mates see them in the street, oh, where is that nice new pair of trainers you bought there? Oh, I don't actually own them. You crazy? But it's all about appearance and how we want other people to perceive us and see us. So when you see people's photos on social media, not faked ones of just ordering clothes, but it's often of the highlights of their life, isn't it? You often see the best parts of what they want you to see, or the worst parts, and it's just them moaning about how the traffic lights didn't change yet again, and I was late for work. But you see people's holiday snaps, and how it's just this beautiful beach they're on, and hot dog legs. And if you know the trend of hot dog leg photos, so it's where people take a photo of the beach, they're on a sun lounger, and you see like their knees, and you're not quite sure whether it's hot dogs or legs. Again, some more homework for you. Just careful what you're Googling later. I felt almost I needed to give you a glossary of terms maybe this morning for social media stuff, because I've done it with young people around theology and doctrine and orthodoxy and all those big complicated words. So maybe this morning, because I'm speaking to a slightly different audience, I need to explain what some of these words are, or weird phrases that are just in the everyday for many, many people nowadays. Or you might see celebrations, so important occasions, birthdays, wedding anniversaries, graduations, all the big important stuff that people like to put out there and say, look how amazing a time we're having together. It's great. This is what our life is like. It could be the latest purchase, so like I said with the Instagram thing, whether it's really been bought or not. Or it could just be a picture of what you're about to eat. People love to take pictures of their food. Mike, do you do this?
Especially if I made it.
I won't blame you. I mean, your food's good. But there is a whole Facebook page dedicated to food called Rate My Plate. Steve is so concerned about the state of the world right now just based on the first 5 minutes. It's in the slow cooker preparing. This isn't just any Sunday lunch. This is a Mike Sunday lunch. Oh, Steve. Oh, M&S, Mike and Sarah. Yeah, Sarah's got nothing to do with this. But do you believe that social media or what you see in the news on the telly is necessarily an accurate representation of what everyday life is for the majority of people? No. So what is everyday? What does it mean? So the dictionary definition of everyday is defined as happening or used every day, daily, or commonplace, or of or for ordinary days, as contrasted with Sundays, holidays, or special occasions. So gone are the days where we have our Sunday best. So generally, if you see me in church, at work, at home, I'm dressed like this. I don't have a Sunday best. I look good all the time.
Equally scruffy.
Yeah. Don't try and find out. She'll try and take a picture while I'm asleep. Just go, oh. But it kind of does part of the job, I think, of explaining what everyday is. Because this morning we are looking at everyday or passion in the everyday. So I think we need to define this word every day, and we'll also define the word passion to see if we can get a better understanding of what passion in the everyday is. So let's start with every day. So hold your horses, Matthew. Hold your horses. This is where I need some audience participation. Now, we haven't got any doctors in this morning, so I haven't got to worry about handwriting. But Rachel, how are dentists' handwriting? Well, volunteered. So, this is where your participation comes in as a collective. So, I don't know if you've heard of the term crowdsourcing or crowdfunding. This morning, I'm going to crowdsource the answer to this question from you, my focus group, my great British public. Oh dear, if this is the state of the nation. So, Rachel, I want two sides. So, we'll have everyday this side and passion that side. So, I need you to shout out words that you think describe every day. So when you think of every day, what does it say to you? What does it mean to you?
Monday.
She's right, she does have. So we've got routine and mundane. Shower. You should shower. It's like you're just giving people general instructions. Please shower every day. If you don't sit next to me on a Sunday. I used to like you, Mike. Any more for every day? Praying. So that's falling to the, a lot of these things are routine. So having a shower, praying daily, it's part of your routine. Any other words you think, positive or negative? Don't think I've got to give the right spiritual answers. Come on, Rachel, you've got a good one. Work. Work.
Quiet time.
Quiet. Eat.
Breakfast.
We're just getting on to the food. People are saying, it's not long to lunchtime now.
Getting up.
Stress. Let me give you a couple that I came up with. Average, repetitive, got mundane, boring, normal, expected, ordinary, regular, commonplace, familiar. I'm not expecting you to write all these down, Rachel. Sorry. So familiar, run-of-the-mill, standard, unremarkable, humdrum, monotonous. When we think about the everyday, it may be these sort of words we think about, because everyday is just what happens all the time. I don't know where you spend most of your time, but I spend my time in the everyday. A lot of life is in between times of exciting events, the everyday. Not every day is a birthday. Not every day is an exam. Not every day is a wedding or a holiday. It's just part of life, but there's a lot of space in between. So we've got quite a good list there, I think. So what about passion? When you think about the word passion, I'm sure it's already been defined through this, the many sermons we've had so far in this teaching series about passion, but what would you say passion is?
Gardening.
Excitement.
Drive.
Zeal. Enthusiasm. Fun. Expectancy. Yeah, can we have some more really, really tricky ones for Rachel to spell? With some silent letters in. Motivated. I like it. Love. Just had. Somebody's been reading my sermon notes. Any more for passion? Yes, coffee. Coffee is. Sorry, I can't be passionate. I've not had my morning coffee yet. People are making up their own jokes back there. So, thank you very much, Rachel. Let's give Rachel a round of applause for a fantastic handwriting. So, If I was to take some of these words, so the other ones I had for passion were zeal, love, obsession, fervor, intensity, enthusiasm, fire, excitement, commitment, compulsion, exuberance. Ooh, exuberance is a fantastic word. So if we're thinking about passion in the everyday and we take all these words and we pull something out that might help us understand a bit more, this is what I came up with. An obsessive, excited, intense love for the familiar, unremarkable, normal, run-of-the-mill. It seems a bit, I'm not sure which side on this one, because you seem to get all these exciting words, but you've also got all these boring words, and how do these two things gel together and make sense in my everyday life? The fact is, the everyday may seem boring and monotonous, but God is incredibly interested in your everyday. In the small details, in the large details, as the psalm that Bill read out, Psalm 139, it says in the first three verses, "You have searched me, Lord, you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise." If that's not talking about every day, I don't know what is. God is interested in when you sit down and when you get up. "You perceive my thoughts from afar." He knows what you're thinking. A lot of our time is spent inside our own heads thinking about stuff. "You discern my going out and my lying down. You know when I get up and go to work. You know when I go to bed. When I'm tired, I'm shattered and I've had enough and maybe I'm not at my best. You are familiar with all of my ways." He cares intensely, passionately about your every day. And we should too. So we're going to explore this a bit together. And the key verse I want to use this morning is John 1:14. It's probably a verse you're all very, very familiar with. We're going to read it in two different translations because I like how the second one puts part of it. It's very gritty. So the first one is going to be from the NIV. And it says, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now we're going to read it in the Message. Because I like this one. I like the Message version. "The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. We saw the glory with our own eyes, the one-of-a-kind glory, like Father, like Son, generous inside and out, true from start to finish." You might be thinking, what on earth has this got to have to do with every day? Because it's a great verse. It's a very well-known verse. It's an inspirational verse. So I think we need to unpack it a little bit. And we're going to unpack it in three words that we're going to focus on. So I've highlighted those in the screen on the next slide for us. So we're going to focus on word. We're going to focus on flesh. We're going to focus on dwell. Okay, there are three words we're going to use to pull this verse apart, look at it, and look at how this applies to our everyday. So I'm making 3 points. So you know when we're getting close to the end, because we're looking at dwell. And you can start to relax. We're coming into land, okay? And the way I've termed these 3 points, okay, is word, everything matters. Flesh, right here, right now. For the Fat Boy Slim fans that are in the house this morning. And dwell, or dwelt, incarnation, not separation. So that's where we're going this morning, okay? So let's start with everything matters. So that word, you've probably heard many sermons on the word, and it being picked apart and what word means. So you're probably familiar with it. It comes from the Greek logos. You can say yes or no. Yes, thank you. And the meaning behind that word is reason, justification, which is righteousness in the sight of God. The plan, the divine reason implicit in the cosmos, ordering it and giving it form and meaning. So behind this word, it said, the Word, so, and we know the Word to be Jesus. When Jesus came, Jesus was the plan. Jesus was the reason. He was righteousness in the sight of God. He ordered it and gave everything meaning. And if we go slightly further back in John 1, we read this about the Word. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made." It's a bit wordy, but Jesus was there right at the very start. Now, I don't know if you ever thought about this, and my brain can only comprehend so much, but the point of creation, Jesus was not a physical human being. He became man when he came to earth. So this word is the Spirit, is Jesus in some other form other than the physical form that we encounter him in the Gospels, being part of creation. He created everything that exists, will exist, will ever exist, and he was at the start of all of it. And I often wonder, how did the Trinity decide how stuff was made up? Did they just kind of sit around on chairs that didn't yet exist because they're not created them, having a coffee and saying, you know what, this is what we should do? But there are some astonishing facts when it comes to how the world is put together. Absolutely mind-boggling, can't understand it. Ugh. So, did you know that 3.5% of the world's oceans are made up of salt? You do now. But did you also know that if there was 0.0000000 whatever figure you want to put on, percent more or less salt in the ocean, if it changed, life could not be sustained on Earth? The Earth is tilted at 23.5 degrees from its upright position. Okay, so we're like this. If it was any more or less on that axis, life could not be sustained on Earth. Did you know the Earth is 149.6 million kilometers from the sun? That's quite a way. I mean, I track my steps on my Fitbit. I don't think I'm ever going to do that. But if we were any closer or further away from the sun, we'd either burn to a crisp or freeze. No life on Earth if we were any closer or further away. The Earth rotates at 460 meters per second. That's roughly 1,000 miles per hour. It's pretty fast. It's pretty fast. It just blows my mind that we don't get just spun off the surface and cast out into space. So 1,000 miles per hour and orbits the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. So we are spinning like this and then spinning around the sun at 67,000 miles per hour. If we went any faster or any slower, life could not be sustained on Earth. Blows my mind. And that's just to name four very quick points, without considering about what would happen if we didn't have the moon to create the tides and all that sort of stuff that helps us basically stay glued to the floor. Just blows my mind about how God put together the Earth. The point is that God was so interested in sustaining our everyday that he made sure things were in precise order in order for us to live here. So if you imagine it like a big dial room and God's like, yep, 3.5% salt. Yep, 23.5% degrees tilt. Right, so at the speed one, this one is a bit more. But if any one of them was out of line, none of it would happen or exist as we know it. Unbelievable. So this idea of word about Jesus being the word at the beginning of creation, everything being created through him that has ever existed and ever will exist, speaks to me that everything matters intensely. He didn't just decide, you know what, we'll just do it like that. Who cares if I miss cut a few corners and don't quite glue it together right, and it'll work. It just speaks of this amazing God who cares so passionately about our everyday. And at that point, he didn't make any differentiation between sacred and secular. He didn't make any difference between spiritual and physical. He was creating stuff through him, by him, and it was all one and the same to him. So often we divide things up as these are spiritual things, these are sacred things. So I don't know if you know much about how the Church of England orders its worship, but they have sacraments, which comes from the word sacred. So things set apart for God. And they are marriage, they are baptism, they are communion, and they are something else which has gone out of my head. Bill? Confirmation. So there are these sacraments which say these are the sacred things. Now, it's not saying saying that they are more important, but they've set them aside, and we've slipped into that sometimes, that we say these things are important and special and for Christian purpose, and the rest kind of doesn't matter. But this verse to me, this word says everything intensely matters to God, so it should matter to us. Which kind of leads me on to our second point this morning, which is right here, right now, focusing on the word flesh, which comes from the Greek sarkikos. It sounds pleasant, doesn't it, sarkikos? So it's got a meaning of became like us, took on human nature, carnal, earthly. Right here, right now. See, Jesus wasn't born on earth just for the exciting stuff. He was born into the everyday. He was born into a stable, into a place where animals were fed and looked after, and it wasn't nice and neat and swept and tidy. It's not like God said, no, 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 no. My son is not being born there. There is pig poo. Can we please tidy this up? And can we get him a really nice mama's and papa's cot? He was born into the everyday of the stable. He was put in a feeding trough amongst itchy, scratchy straw, amongst smelly, stinky animals. They travelled for days. Mary and Joseph probably stank horrendously. The weather in Jerusalem at that time is not like the weather here. The weather in Bethlehem is not like the weather here. It is hot, it is sticky, it is gross. All of that going on, Jesus was born into that. And have you ever thought that he was born at a specific time, a specific place in history? Not just some far-off distant land in a galaxy far, far away. And he looked a specific way. He had specific facial features. He was a specific height. Ever thought that he learnt to walk and he learnt to talk? He didn't just come out of the womb saying, Mother, I am the Son of God, and trying to give him a bath and the water just parting. That's not how it worked. He had to learn to do stuff like we did it, because if he came to earth as a human, if he came with flesh on, he had to go through all the stuff we go through. So that means he would have fallen over and cut his knee, and Mary would have had to cuddle him because he hurt himself and he was in pain. It meant that he went through puberty. We don't like to think about that. We don't even like to think about it at our own kids. Scares the living daylights out of me that one day I'm going to have to deal with two teenage boys. The only solace is it's not two teenage girls. Rachel smiling, she's like, I put my parents through that. But he had to deal with the complexity of making friends and maintaining relationships. He had to learn and be taught by people that were older than him, educated, and go through all that. He had to learn how to do what his dad did. And I don't mean do what God did. I mean do what Joseph did. For 30 years, Jesus was learning from Joseph how to be a carpenter. He was studying what his father did, and that's what he did before he started his public ministry. He was building tables and chairs. He was making items for everyday use for everyday people. He had his feelings hurt. He felt betrayed. He felt that he'd been let down. He grieved over the death of someone that was close to him. Now, after the first few chapters of the Gospels, we don't read about Joseph anymore. So at some point, Joseph must have died. Have we ever thought that that really got to Jesus, that it hurt him? That he went through that everyday stuff that we have to go through? We go through grief. We all know what it's like to lose someone. But Jesus went through that. He felt hungry. He felt tired. He was tempted. He laughed. He cried. He got angry. He was excited. He was bored. He went through every emotion that we go through every day because he was born on earth in the constraints of earth. He was totally human, yet fully God. The mind-blowing paradigm that we can never fully comprehend, but we can know that he went through everything that we go through. Just recalibrating, bear with. And Again, all of that says to me that right here and right now is important. Jesus didn't just come as some sort of traveller, passerby, through, easy time, like a tourist. He went through it all. Often I've heard it described as we want Jesus to kind of be like the SAS and kind of zip wire down, rescuers and takers back up. Way, we're all safe. But Jesus didn't do that. Jesus was there for the long haul. He was an embedded special ops agent. There to infiltrate, there to change, disrupt, and transform. He was an undercover agent, but not particularly covert about being undercover. He's quite obvious about why he was there. And it all just says that what we do with our lives now is important. The decisions you do and don't make are important, and they affect the world around you. And one of the most quoted Bible verses is John 3:16, which says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believed in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." There's a word in there which is world, and the Greek word for world in this part is cosmos. And cosmos, which you've probably heard of, when you talk about the cosmos, you think about space. But in Greek, cosmos means the entirety of everything, the sum total of all the parts that make up the existing universe that we know about and can possibly comprehend, and the bits we can't comprehend. So when we read this verse, it says, "For God so loved everything," not just individual people, not just the plants, not just the trees, but everything. God so loved the whole world that he sent his Son, because everything matters, as I said in the first point, and it's all about right here, right now. He sent his Son into the right here, right now. Which says to me that the world outside our doors, here on a Sunday morning, where you spend most of your time, in the everyday, matters. So we need to now look at this word dwelt. And for this, it's incarnation, not separation. So dwelt is skenu. It's the sort of word that's just pleasant to say. Skenu. And this is a really interesting word. The meaning behind this one is to have one's tent or tabernacle. Now, we all understand what a tent is. Many of us go camping. I'll be spending a week in a field with 27 young people. I'm just waiting for the panic to set in across Sarah's face as she realizes that's what she signed up for. So we understand this idea of tent, but tabernacle, it's not a word we use a lot. It's a word we may hear in church. And where it comes from, our understanding of tabernacle, is the Old Testament. So if you were to look back in the book of Exodus and the people traveling through the wilderness after they escaped from Egypt, the tabernacle was the place where worship happened. Moses was given specific instructions about the size of the tabernacle, what should be in the tabernacle, how the tabernacle was to be used, how it was to be set up. Tabernacle has lost all meaning now because I've just said tabernacle too many times. But the tabernacle was the movable place where God came and dwelt among his people. So when the Israelites moved, the tabernacle moved with them. The presence of God went with them and dwelt in that tabernacle. And then when they eventually built the temple, God's glory came and resided in that temple, in that place. It was God's address on earth. So when John is writing to his audience at the time, 2,000 years ago, and he's using this word dwelt, it's got more meaning to it than we really comprehend. He's saying, the word became flesh. God came down, put skin on, got bones, was no longer just some spirit cloud pillar of fire. And he moved into the neighborhood. He tabernacled amongst us. The God of your forefathers, of Abraham, of Isaac, of Jacob, is in your midst now. That is what John is saying to his people. But we miss it because we like to read verses and quote them and get inspired by them. But when we understand what the original writer was trying to say, wow! So this would have been shocking to John's audience. Absolutely shaking the foundations of the established religious order at the time. You're saying that this God that we honour and when we do go and worship, we can only go into his presence once a year. I don't know if you know anything about temple worship, but it was crazy difficult. So ignoring all the sacrifices and stuff, but the priest, the high priest, who was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies one time a year, had to have a special bath before he went in, put on a white linen gown with no impurities, weaved from one single sheet of fabric, then put on an ephod with 12 stones embedded into it that represent the 12 tribes of Israel, and had a special turban that he had to wear, and he couldn't go in forwards, he had to go in backwards. And he, not only that, he also had to go in swinging incense, because if anyone saw the glory of God, they would be consumed by fire and die. So he had to cover this whole place in the Holy of Holies with smoke and sweet-smelling incense in order that he couldn't see anything. And it was behind a curtain that was as thick as the span of a man's hand. So not talking like the curtain was only this big, we're talking that the curtain was huge. We're talking the width of this room and really high, and it was that thick. And he had to go behind it and then offer this sacrifice once a year by sprinkling blood everywhere. But then it still wasn't finished. So he had to come out and then go through all the washing rituals again. So when John is talking about the tabernacle and it's relating to the temple and ordered worship they had to go through, he's blowing people's minds. Because he's saying, the place that you went to worship to meet with your God is now here among you. Jesus incarnated totally what he meant to be God in human form, in amongst people. He wasn't separate from, he wasn't behind a curtain, he wasn't in a special building, he was there in the day-to-day, walking along the streets, eating with people, talking with people, calling people down from trees, letting them wash his feet, letting them cry over him. He was there at funerals, raising children from the dead. He was there going to his mate, get out of that tomb, you don't need to be in there. He wasn't separating himself off in some sort of holy of holy huddles. He was fully in the everyday of everyone, not separating himself off. But it kind of leaves us with a bit of a conundrum, because in Acts, we read that Jesus then ascended to heaven in a human form. So like we said at the beginning of creation, Jesus was not physical. However, Jesus is physical now, which then is another weird thing to try and comprehend, that Jesus is somewhere that's not earth, but completely physical right now. Don't even try and think about it. But we read in Acts that the God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. So he no longer lives in a tabernacle. He no longer resides in a temple. So where does he live? In 1 Corinthians 6, 19 to 20, it says, do you not know that your bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. God no longer dwells in the temples of old. God lives amongst his people, in us. We are the temple of God. We are the place that God resides and dwells on this earth. We are called to be in the present, here and now with people. We're to tell people that it matters. Life matters. It matters what you do with it. We're to incarnate God's love to them. We're not to be separated from them. So we are carriers of the holy dwelling place. Where heaven meets earth, we are to bring that to our here and now for people. I suppose it kind of leaves us with a bit of a, so what? Great, we've looked at this verse, but so what? I've got to go to work tomorrow morning. I've got to go into my everyday. And to be honest, my everyday is pretty rubbish. I don't get on with my colleagues. The kids are going to wake me up at 6. And I'm going to pretend like I'm asleep. And then I'm going to get an elbow in the back from my wife because I pretended to be asleep. There's going to be stuff that will happen tomorrow. That you'd be like, so what? We've talked about it every day, but this passion thing that we defined as an obsessive, excited, intense love for the familiar, a remarkable, normal run of the mill. How on earth am I going to be passionate about that? Because it is unremarkable. It is normal. It is run of the mill. But it's because of what Jesus did, as we've explored in John 1:14. Because the very presence of God came to dwell amongst us in order that we might have relationship with him and share that relationship with other people. Because Jesus is something that we often teach, but we don't catch. Jesus came like an infection that can't be gotten rid of. And when you catch Jesus and someone else meets you, they catch Jesus from you because you become a carrier. You are the dwelling place of the Holy Spirit. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. When people meet you, they meet Jesus. They see him reflected in you, in through how you live your life, how you conduct yourself, how you go about your day-to-day, how you speak to people, how you treat people. But it does mean the Bible study, the home group, the Sunday service, the youth clubs are just as important as going to work, doing your weekly shopping in the supermarket, doing the school run, going out with your friends, being part of your local sports club. They're all of equal importance. And each of those activities has just as much spiritual significance as each other. So whether you're at a prayer meeting or with your friends down the pub, it's just as much spiritual significance. Because like I said, we sometimes like to divide them. But how on earth are your mates down the pub going to ever hear about Jesus unless it comes from someone who knows Jesus? We could invite them to a prayer meeting, sure. We can invite them to an outreach event. But surely we should be spending time with our friends where they need us, rather than trying to, come on, come into our special club. It means ultimately that your life is significant and that you matter more than you could ever know. And that's really what should drive your passion in your everyday. Your everyday matters, and it matters to someone else that you're here. Thank you.